Say Hello, an elementary verse story by Fly Kate, read by Winking Star. It's officially a miracle, John decides. They've been at the museum nearly all day, and no real disasters. The realist in him is forced to add, yet. Sure, Emma had thrown up on the bus over, but then she always did, poor kid, and Paul Stevens had thrown a sandwich at lunch. John was counting the last as a plus, however, because it meant that Mrs. Stevens would really unleash holy hell at the upcoming parent-teacher conference, the kind of look that made even John sit up straighter. Still, room 12 is all mostly engaged and halfway respectable-looking, and John even has time to go to the bathroom, thank God for parent chaperones, though as he weaves his way back past the lines snaking into the restrooms, he wonders if he's pressed his luck. John is still working his way smilingly but quickly around several other school groups and some families when he catches sight of Jenna Howard, madly scribbling in a notebook in case she gets quizzed about this later, and over there is Karen and her dad. No one else had hair that red except Greg, which meant that all, or at least a large number, of his kids were still alive and mostly behaving. It would have been really hard to explain otherwise to Elizabeth Weir. But oh, above the hum of excitement of being in a museum, because even at its most boring, it is decidedly not school, he could hear what can only be Peter, irrepressible, irrefutable Peter Adams, arguing about the human body? Near enough that John feels like a sneaky eavesdropper and, listening, he's struck with a double wave of hilarity and that special kind of embarrassment that being in charge of overly inquisitive children can bring. Dude, the awesomest part of your body is totally your bones. I mean, they grow and stuff, and without them, we'd be a big pile of skin and all squishy with blood and our livers down on our knees. The short chorus of "Ew" and "Cool" tells John that Peter has an audience, most likely the rest of the class, and probably all behind that nearby display of the bones of the foot. But then another voice chimes in, and the embarrassment looms exponentially, because this isn't a marginally silly and ungrammatical, John cringes, talk with a passing kid, but someone older, old in a bitingly sarcastic way that makes John stutter a step in surprise. How picturesque. While your imagery is compellingly vivid, the importance of how strong or cool your bone structure is kind of pales in comparison to the brain's ability to amass and analyze large amounts of information, regulate breathing, and, oh, I don't know, do everything of interest. So you want to just be a really smart jellyfish, then? This was Susie Corrigan, who usually let others take the lead. The man, arguing with second graders? Seriously? Coughs out a short and grudging laugh. Ha! Better a squishy jellyfish than a moron who can stand up straight, he says, and John has to laugh at that. Squish! Says Alec with something like satisfaction, and there's another giggle-filled chorus of "Ew!" that rises in pitch even as it dissolves into the shriek of Linda poking Jeff in the back. Look, I'm squishing you! And then Brandon starting a highly enthusiastic story about some guy in a movie he saw once who'd been a brain in a jar, only a brain, gross, and there was this other guy who used it to... Here, the man throws in some data point on the science of neurotransplants, and John decides that maybe he needs to make an appearance. Okay, guys, he pokes his head around the edge of a colorful display on the circulatory system, sees a ring of his students and a guy in jeans and a rumpled button-down. 10 more minutes, then we're heading out. There's a low rumble of groans, but the kids quickly scatter, with a drive-by kind of hugging cling from Susie, who gets like that sometimes, to see their most favorite exhibit one last time, or spend the last few precious minutes wandering in and out of the human heart replica. And yeah, Mr. Shepherd, they knew it wasn't a real heart. Duh. Finally, it's just John and the guy who got talked down by some second graders. He isn't, John notices, much older than John himself. A little more tired looking, but otherwise the only remarkable thing about him is the way his hair sort of tufts from his head with the same overly bright energy he'd used to debate with Peter. He meets John's gaze, eyes smart and a little fierce, but then drops it as he seems to evaluate the situation. Strange guy talking to kids that apparently are in some way John's. It's important for kids to be able to debate, especially about scientific matters, he says. Which wouldn't have sounded like an apology, because John gets the sense from it that the guy doesn't make many and wouldn't do them well if he did. Except he looks a little embarrassed and talks a little fast, like he thinks John's ready to call security about the weird guy who debates with strange children. Yeah, it's a little weird, but hey, kids are weird. So John cuts him some slack because it wasn't like the kids hadn't started it, and it had been an interesting discussion. Might show up in the next week's writing assignments. What do you think is the most important part of the body? Give examples. I'll be sure to mention to Peter's dad that he stayed up past his bedtime. There's no way that something like the man with two brains would show up earlier than midnight. Which really isn't what he'd meant to say, but John decides to roll with it. At least it was from before Steve Martin stopped being funny, the guy answers, with a little quirk to his lips like he was equally bemused by the way this conversation is going. True, John says. After a not quite awkward pause, he gets out. I'm John. Rodney, I'm Rodney, the guy replies almost too rapidly, and the same nervous look is back, like he fears that John had forgotten, but now remembers that here is a stranger near his kids. And it's not like I hang around in museums to trick kids into answering questions about cardiovascular trivia for some creepy reason or whatever. I have a perfectly respectable job that involves an office and textbooks and no bars on the windows, so I hope you aren't going to be pissed that you're a little. Which one was yours? All of them, actually. The guy, Rodney, pauses. John can almost hear the gears turning. Either you're just in charge, or I've stumbled onto this bizarre group of family situation that you only see on one of those channels with documentaries about quintuplets and medical miracles. Not that I'm judging if you are, of course. I mean, my family wasn't exactly something to write glowing reviews about, and if you're taking them to a museum, that's a positive cultural experience. I think the only time I spent with my dad was watching TV when he yelled at the hockey refs. Rodney, John gets in, when it's clear that this isn't ending any time soon. I'm their teacher. They're my students. So technically, all of them and none of them are mine. Oh, and Rodney blinks. Sorry. John, right? John, sorry. Not that I'm sorry you're their teacher, or that you are a teacher, of course. I teach college students at UPenn, and I'm sure by the time I get back, all my TAs will have been terrorized into giving up my answer keys. Wait, if you're their teacher, then don't tell me it was you who gave that kid the line about your liver and your knees. Hey, says John, and a grin is taking over the amused shame that kids will repeat what you say, no matter how stupid. If they remember it, it can't all be bad. Whatever Rodney's about to say, and it has to be something, the guy's not exactly quiet. John's attention is taken instead by Karen's dad, standing near the door of the room and gesturing at his watch. Time to go. When John looks at Rodney again, it's clear he saw and understands the motioning. Gotta get back, John says, though part of him, the part that's enjoying the conversation, even the fact that Rodney seems to be unable to talk with any kind of filter at all, wishes it wasn't true. Yeah, especially seeing as they're not yours, Rodney smiles a bit. Well, good luck. Traffic's going to be terrible. As usual, John replies. He turns, but something makes him turn back. Hey, Rodney. What do you teach? Rodney looks surprised, something that John thinks must not happen very often. Still, a good look for him. Teach? Me? I teach physics and astrophysics to a small group of mostly competent undergrads and a growing number of morons who should really just be English majors. As much as John is dying to mention that he minored in English at college, he continues on with a smile that he wishes wasn't so shy. Maybe you'd want to come talk to my kids about some of it? Give Peter another run for his money? Stupid is his first thought. Lame, even if it's not totally, well, not entirely, an excuse. What college professor would want to waste time telling little kids about hard sciences and spend time with yelling and questions and knowing Room 12 a disaster or two? Damn, he's bad at this. I. Sure, says Rodney, and his smile is miles less nervous than it was. Okay, Room 12, Front Hall in 20, time to get back on the bus. Even though he can't pick out specific kids yet, and wow, how much does he owe the world to his parent chaperones for all this? Also, is he seriously making a not quite but sort of date in the middle of a school day? Focus, John. There's a murmured cheer and subtle mass migration towards the exit. Then, here, and John digs in the pocket of his jeans, comes up with an extra of the cards he gave to all his kids in case they got lost. They're embarrassingly bright pink and say, "First rule, don't panic." But most importantly, they have John's cell and email address. Rodney's hand is warm, and he catches the edges of John's fingers as he closes his hand around the card. "Okay, great," Rodney grins. John does too, then flushes a bit. Shit, he's gonna be the last person on the bus, and Kelly's mom can read him like a book, and eventually Taylor would find out. She has ways, and he would never hear the end of it. You knew, I'm sure, that jellyfish don't actually have brains, John says, feeling the remains of a stupid grin still clinging to his face. Yeah, admits Rodney, and flushes a little like he's embarrassed. But they probably didn't. I'll fix that, John promises, mostly to make Rodney laugh, which it does, so John can leave with a bouncy, amused feeling that doesn't even dim when Emily is sick again on the way home, and Rodney and Harry nearly come to blows over a highly intense game of Go Fish. Right before he turns off the lights in room 12, all children finally parceled off to cars and babysitters and away, he glances into Tolstoy's cage, gives the eternally zen-looking turtle what must be an exceedingly goofy grin. Best field trip yet, buddy. Next time I'll bring you back something. Click. The end.
Rainy Day, an elementary verse pick by Fly Kate. Read by Rhea 314. John was disappointed to find that while he'd been innocently sleeping only moments before, he was now awake. Awake and desperately trying not to be. Somewhere close by he could hear the tap of rain on the bedroom window. But it wasn't here. Here he was warm and dry and awake. Because of a noise, close to the patter of rain on the glass, but not quite. Damn. He pulled the blankets tighter, burrowing deeper to keep the cold out and sleep in. He debated sticking his whole head in there, but decided that it wouldn't be worth breathing through the muggy, stale air. Besides, the bed felt big. Too big. Sighing, John stuck his head out to see Rodney seated in the armchair by the bookshelf, one foot tucked up under him as he rapidly typed on the laptop. John tried, then swallowed and worked on actual vocal cords. Saturday, Rodney. Yes, beauty sleep and all that, but there was this idea I had. Remember I was telling you about Virek's total and comprehensively idiotic theory about black holes, and the way that the gravity... Well, I just had to write it down, because I swear you shouldn't even be allowed to come within 20 miles of the university, let alone teach there, and... Rodney, John said, then paused and waited, and whatever he could have put in there along with Rodney's name made him stop typing, though John had to smile when he could hear Rodney compulsively hit save. Yes? Come back to bed. But it's Saturday, John said, and something in Rodney's face softened as he murmured, okay, all, but then stopped, slowly set down the laptop, tugged at the blankets, and curled himself around John before he could whine about the cold. Saturday, John mumbled, and could feel Rodney nod against his neck. No thinking on Saturdays, John said, and now Rodney was laughing. That might be impossible if you count the subconscious types of muscle movement and when you... But by then John had shifted, turned around and found Rodney's mouth. It was the kind of kiss they had time for on Saturdays, a lazy, reflective one that meant no rushing for the door, no appointments or lectures or school-age emergencies, only the passage of breath past teeth and tongue, the haze of pleasurable non-thinking, no matter what Rodney said, if he could say, that let them be, just be. For once. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback for the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this story's post. Thanks for listening.
Thermoregulation, an elementary verse story by Flya Kate. Read by Bessie Boo. Why isn't it snowing? Rodney's irritated whine had stopped sounding mature hours ago. Rodney, it's July. Still, it's July. In Pennsylvania. John tries to sound patient and keep the edge out of his voice, but he started getting a headache last 20 minutes ago, and the continued blast of too warm air from the open window and the persistent itch of sweat trickling down his neck into his t-shirt is driving him slowly crazy. Yeah... Rodney says, sounding defeated and sulky and not much older than 6. Any cooler down there? John says, amused despite his slightly cranky wriggle on the overly warm couch. I'll have you know that cold air sinks, Rodney declares with an impressive amount of volume, especially considering he's lying flat on the carpeted living room floor about a foot away. Then why is there snow on top of mountains? John argues, tipping his beer to catch the last few almost cold drops in his mouth. Rodney starts babbling about pressure zones and geological shifts, and then gets distracted into recounting a childhood memory of a freak snowstorm in August, then a bitter diatribe about the ridiculousness of a Batman villain not only being called Mr. Freeze, but by then being played by the governor of California, of all people. By this time, the breeze feels like it's cooled, helped no doubt by the frequent application of cold beer and a short washcloth fight. And John stops thinking about his headache, so he slides off the couch to curl next to Rodney on the carpet and lazily nap away the time until dinner. The end.
Teachers do it in red pen. A Stargate Atlantis fic, fourth in the elementary verse, written by Flyer Kate, read by my fic. In second grade, the morning is always filled with the same classroom activities, reading groups and math workbooks and the occasional spelling test. John thinks they should be called misspelling tests, but that's a whole other issue. But the afternoons rotate between PE, Spanish, spending quiet time in Atlantis's library, for a given definition of quiet, and art, depending on the day. Room 12 will be dismissed from Spanish with Alicia down the hall in a little more than half an hour, and John has enough experience with the flow of ending class, lining up, and the time it will take for Aidan to walk them back, one of the perks of having a student teacher, to know that he has more than enough time to head to the teacher's lounge for a breather. If Cal has been through recently, there might even be a fairly fresh pot of coffee. Gathering up a stack of papers, he's learned to use every spare second to keep on top of correcting the quizzes and tests and papers and reports, even seconds devoted to caffeine consumption. And sticking a green pen in his pocket, John digs through the mess on his desk, finally unearths that morning's coffee cup, which reads, Atlantis Academy, Growing Young Minds, in dishwasher-chipped green ink, a motto that always sounded to John like it was one step from the zombie apocalypse. From its new hiding place under his teaching planner, and walks down the almost quiet hallway to the lounge. The teacher's lounge at Atlantis Academy actually has two doors. The one that opens, marked Room 4A in faded green paint, and the one slightly further down the hall that doesn't. Storage used to be written there, but has been painted over in the same pine colour that covers all the doors. A holdover from the room's previous use as two separate classrooms. Even though they keep and have kept the door locked since the renovations, there are always a handful of people who try to open it, ineffectually pushing at it until they remember and act like it never happened, even when there are lines of giggling students and even, hypothetically, a tour of prospective parents walking by. Not that this happened to John or anything, and not that his class from 2 years ago will ever stop reminding him about it. John is blissfully working his way through a cup of coffee with too much sugar, trying to stay ahead of the crash sure to come from a long morning running on too little sleep, Rodney's fault as much as his, and too little protein in his breakfast. Seeing as Rodney snagged the last power bar from the pantry, that's all on him. And mostly tuning out the conversations around him. The caffeine hasn't kicked in. Glad to simply sit and be off for a moment. Fortunately, the rest of the crowd in the room, Laura and Joanna, each elbow deep in papers, Ronan debating with Taylor about a new form of martial arts he was planning on teaching the middle schoolers, are happy to leave him be. Wasn't it just summer? Carson remarks to the room as he pushes the door open with an elbow, both hands full with what John expects are lab reports, judging by the glossy plastic covers. I swear, yesterday I was catching a lovely fish in the river down the way from Mother's, and the next thing I know, I'm knee-deep in seventh-grade papers that are trying to convince me that several laws of motion are actually wrong, thanks ever so. Not to mention that certain of the finer points of grammar are apparently optional. Cheers. This last is to Ronan, who's kicked a chair out from the table so that Carson can sit. Weren't they supposed to learn grammar in fifth grade? John tries to sound innocent as he says this, but then can't stop a grin when Joanna Browning growls something uncomplimentary from further down the table next to a large pile of spelling tests. If the firm circles of red pen and overall desperately erased and rewritten state of them are any indication. I've found that it can take many years for a concept to fully be grasped, says Taylor with her usual calm. And as usual, John can only be slightly confident that she's actually being sarcastic. Just like they learned Greek myths in second, right, John? Says Laura Cadman, who still manages to look poised, despite a smudge of marker on her cheek and what looks like several pounds worth of reading journals spread before her. Hey, I'm pretty sure the whole Peter Parker gets bitten by a radioactive spider plotline is something the Greeks could have totally gotten behind, John argues. A pity, then, that Marvel Comics doesn't grade the unit tests, says Taylor. And remembering the creative answers he saw last week, John figures it's smarter to keep his mouth shut. Who's got my kids? Asks Laura, as she scribbles into another journal. This question would sound nearly philosophical if it wasn't one that John had asked himself out loud or silently about 10 times a day. Of course, it prompted John to start thinking hurriedly about where his kids might be. Oh, right, Spanish, thank goodness. Because what time is it? Hell, what day is it? This was worth sitting, even for coffee, beautiful coffee, was dangerous. Mine are in music, Joanna says, and John's had one of those days, because he can easily hear the unspoken, and I hope never to see them again. Upper graders are still at lunch, is Taylor's offering, with only a pinch of smug to her serenity. Well, I don't have yours until 10 after, Ronan murmurs to Laura, and she hurriedly flies up out of her chair and lets loose with some language that's not quite safe for work. Shit, I have my kids, and she gulps the last of her coffee and is out the door. Jennifer had lunch duty. She'll watch them till Laura gets there, says Carson with a slightly concerned glance at his own watch. John, shouldn't you be getting back? The bell is about to go. Aiden knows the drill. He'll get them settled. This sounds much more mature than the, oh, 5 more minutes, Mom, that is running through John's head. Weren't you just telling me yesterday that the class had been particularly rambunctious this week? Asks Taylor, with an edge to her voice that makes John continue to feel like a whiny kid. Actually, John had said the kids were being huge pains in the ass, but that's a pretty close translation for Taylor. John slouches, tilts an eyebrow. He's late to get back now. Might as well milk 1 more minute out of the situation. Hey, he argues, I thought Ford would enjoy a chance to hone those management skills if he wants to have his own classroom some day. Although, John thinks, it might be a little cruel to abandon Ford to a class full of post-Spanish, adrenalized second graders. Alicia was great, and hits on Lawn like crazy when the Atlanta staff come to John's softball games, but that's a whole other story. But runs a tight ship, meaning that kids like Henry and Alec and Stacy are probably busting at the seams by now. Maybe I should get back, John says a little sheepishly, and stands. If you're headed that way, I'm sure Laura'd appreciate you dropping off those notebooks first, Ronan says placidly, tilting his chin towards the tilting pile of reading journals Cadman abandoned in her panic. After all, it takes practice to thrive in chaos, Taylor says, and now her eyes are bright with laughter. Now that's just cruel, protests Carson, but he's holding back laughter, and Taylor looks wickedly mischievous. So John laughs and obligingly scoops up the well-used composition books and figures. Hell, Ford will forgive him. Eventually. Aiden's glare, when John also innocently wanders back into room 12, is kind of priceless, but the burst of wildness that the kids got thoroughly derails the social studies lesson that is supposed to follow, as well as any possibility of a smooth, quiet rotation of science small groups. Not a chance in hell. Instead, John makes the decision on the fly to pull out some of the pipe cleaners he's been hoarding since last March. Kids have literally and metaphorically sticky fingers, and some rulers. And it's, who can build the longest ladder using an ABA pattern? This is why they pay me the big bucks, John says to Aidan with a smirk, though his feet are already moving towards Ricky Daniels, whose hand is raised to wind a purple pipe cleaner in Stacy's braids. He can hear Aidan mutter, "I hate you," as he moves away, although at least he sounds like he's laughing. Thriving in chaos, indeed. It's Thursday, and while John sort of feels like he's still standing, only through luck and a judicious application of caffeine, Jennifer learned long ago that her last unofficial job before leaving the staff's office was to make a fresh pot of coffee, bless her. He made it. The last kid has been walked, or in Henry's case, more like frog-marched, down to the carpool line, or sent off in the direction of after-school care. John sticks a leaf of lettuce into Tolstoy's cage. Someone has labelled it AWESUMTRTLE, Awesome Turtle, when he wasn't looking. That's one for the scrapbook. And for one precious moment, all John has to do is stand there. But there's something he's supposed to do. His brain keeps catching on a fragment of conversation from this morning, right after snarking at Rodney for grabbing the last power bar and before they parted ways towards car and train station with coffee-laced kisses that jolted better than caffeine. Something about today, something that he's doing because it's... Thursday, John remembers, with a yell. Chuck, passing by the door with a cart full of laptops, gives John a weird look, but hey, that's not new. It's Thursday, which means softball practice, which means John needs to get his butt out the door and home into the field in exactly, he checks his watch, -5 minutes ago. Crap. John tells himself to get a grip. If the guys actually cared if he was on time, he would have been kicked off Helling's Hotshots. The original name had been Helling's Hardwood Hard Hitters, but everyone had vetoed that lengthy amount of alliteration long ago. Fortunately, traffic is working in his favour for once, and by the time he drags himself back into the car, after a 2-minute stare-down with the siren call of the couch in the living room, Lorna and some of the guys are only just warming up. John sits on a bench in the dugout to lace up his cleats, feeling all those weird muscles that tighten from standing up all day already starting to bitch a bit, because it's been a long day and the temperature's dropping along with the sun. He's digging through the crap in his gym and marvelling at what it is that makes something as big as a mitt disappear into thin air, because he knows he put it in there. He's just closing his fingers on his glove and triumphantly pulling it when he hears Lawn call out, "Hey, Doc!" And he sees the brilliantly ridiculous orange of Rodney's fleece out the corner of his eye and goes to meet him by the bleachers. "Thought you had class," John says, and then, "Ooh, coffee," as he snags the thermos for a grateful slurp. Rodney raises an expressive eyebrow at the noise. "It's midterms this week, and while I now have to grade the mind-numbing pile of essays that my freshman class has come up with in the hopes of passing, I can pawn all the short answer and multiple choice sections off on my TAs. I was thinking you would enjoy a supporter at your weekly display of athletic manliness." Here Rodney raises an expressive eyebrow at the empty bleachers. "But seeing as you appear to only love me for my possession of a warm beverage, I might just leave." "I can always tell when you've had the intro glass," John says with a laugh, as he, only a little bit reluctantly, returns the coffee thermos. "You use way bigger words." Rodney rolls his eyes. "You hit ball, me watch. Happy now?" "Exuberant," John says. He leans over to press a kiss to Rodney's temple. "If you get too cold, the car keys are in the side pocket of my bag." "If I get too cold, you owe me a beer after," Rodney argues. But John's already walking back towards the field and pretends not to hear him. Summer has its perks. Carson does have a point. But fall means new students, new field trips. It's almost time to take this new batch of kids to the Franklin Institute again. That'll make Rodney smile. New moments of hilarity and terror and frustration and accomplishment and chaos and calm. And finally, It means the warmth of stolen coffee and the sound of Rodney's outraged shouting from the sideline when John is so clearly, absolutely, undeniably safe at third. Is the umpire blind? The end.
October and February. An Elementary Verse Fic by Flya Kate. Read by Rhea 314. When it hits October, John can feel the whole school practically heave a sigh of relief, students and teachers both. John and Room 12 have been together for a little over a month. They've successfully navigated the first fire drill, or three, a handful of playground disagreements, and most of the first unit in the math textbook. There are no more surprises, no more unknowns, only routine day after day. Of course, these are kids, so John learns that while he's planned to do a really cool, interesting lesson on the water cycle, he has to abort 5 minutes in because half the second graders think it's more fun to smash their plastic cups into splinters on the floor. He doesn't really want to know where the rest of the food coloring went. Still, John's grinning when he comes home late in the afternoon with an armful of papers to look over. He'd say grade, but it's still early enough in the year and in life that he mostly gives out stickers. No need for a 7-year-old to freak out about misspelling foliage, or for thinking that leaves are really just confused flowers that decided to grow on the side of the tree. He's long since forgotten about the several different shades of green marker making their way up his arm. So, the nature unit is going about as well as water, I see? Rodney says with a roll of his eyes, but instead of launching into a lecture on how children need discipline, otherwise they'll keep doing stupid things until they're old enough to be taught by Rodney, and the rising numbers of absolute morons in the hard sciences is only proof that. Instead, Rodney just takes half of John's papers, makes an amused face at the tops to try to explain why leaves change color. Maybe they're jealous because we change clothes and they don't get to? Wouldn't you like to be red and orange, too? And holds the door into the living room, where Franklin is curled up in a furry parentheses, on the rug, and to an extra mug of hot chocolate still warm. In February, John's desk gets absolutely covered in notes, with hearts and pink marker drawings, only slightly different from the rest of the year, because he's noticed second graders will produce reams of art on any surface, for any real or imagined reason, with methods of spelling his last name and Valentine's Day that he'd never really considered. This, of course, is on top of his usual collection of dogs, with Mr. Shepherd rules, spilling out of jaunty speech bubbles, and violent monster creatures with impossibly too many teeth, that make him seriously consider a week of lessons on animal anatomy, if only to make the kids' drawings more realistic. That, he realizes, is a thought born of living with Rodney, and it makes him grin all day. With a grin and enthusiastic thank yous, he gathers up every scrap of paper, waving a stack of glued flowers and hearts. And was that a dinosaur holding a heart? Wow. To stick in his backpack. And it's only when he gets home that he notices that not only has Amanda's dazzling Valentine creation disintegrated into little pink and blue scraps, now glued to the lining of his bag, but that the glitter she'd liberally doused it with came off on John's hands, and the sleeve of his shirt, and the side of his face. At this rate, we'll need another file cabinet for your fan mail, Rodney says with a smirk as he attempts to deglitter John's face with a wet paper towel. It's not like I can get rid of them, John argues half-heartedly, more than a little nauseous with the memory of all the candy he ate today. They mean a lot. Although seeing as some of the kids in his class can churn out 8 sketches of fighter planes in the time it takes him to turn around from the board, this is slightly less than true. And Rodney knows what that he means it means a lot to John, and so smiles and places them in the bulging manila folder. I have to admit, I'm impressed by your attempt to single-handedly save all of your students from sugar shock, Rodney continues, pulling another handful of crumpled wrappers out of John's coat pocket. Sadly, I don't think it works that way, John says. Those kids practically vibrated out of school today. I'm sure I'll get a barrage of notes tomorrow and 3 meltdowns before lunch. Rodney's mostly not listening anymore, off on a rant about sugar comas, which veers into the question of whether any parents gave him Valentines, especially Joey's single mom, and he could tell that there was something in the fact that she hung around, getting into conversations that was really transparent attempts to go to coffee with. Adam, actually, John says. You know Kylie's dad? I heard that they're going out and they're both chaperoning at Joey's birthday party this weekend, so I'll keep you posted. John's biting his lip to keep from laughing, and just when Rodney's taking a breath to complain more, John slides 2 candy hearts into Rodney's hand, pale green be mine and kiss, a little sticky from being carried around in John's pocket and held tight in his hand. But hell, it's the thought that counts. And John has to laugh out loud at the look on Rodney's face, part affection, part ew. "You don't have to eat them if you don't want to," John says. Rodney grins finally and slips the candies into his mouth, leaning forward to breathe, "do want to," against John's lips until John's lost in it. He even forgets to tease Rodney when he comes up with smears of glitter on his cheek, especially when Rodney himself doesn't notice until bedtime. Then, of course, John laughs himself silly until Rodney throws pillows at him. Franklin, lounging nearby on the floor, hopes that someone will remember to give a treat to the poor, starving, adorable cat, is not amused. But then, cats never are. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback to the author. You can do that at a link to this text through the story's post. Universal Gravitation, an Elementary Verse Fic, by Flya Kate, read by Rhea 3 and 4. John remembers learning how touchy and hands-on his students actually are. They hand him things, offer up unlatchable braces and watches for his help, while he forever marvels at how skinny they are at this age, how faithfully they look up to him to fix, repair, mend. They all try to teach him their recess clapping games, complex rhythms of liked hands, a never-changing chants, Miss Mary Mac, 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 all dressed in black, 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 that he forever fumbles, which collapses them into laughter. If he's leading the kids to lunch, or the library, or anywhere, whoever's in front will frequently just latch onto his hand, like drawn there by some bizarre form of gravity, clinging to fingers with unthinking strength that he's grown to appreciate, especially as if he's having the kind of day where he thinks that he's the worst teacher in the world, like when he made Jesse cry, mostly due to a post-sugary breakfast crash, but still. Or when no one had understood the math lesson and he'd sort of yelled, kind of a lot, oops. Or when he'd had to send Harry to the office, again. In class, there's taps and pokes when he walks the rows of desks. The hesitant but unrelenting brushes on his hands, pant leg, shoulder, if he's been guilted into crouching down to their height. Because they always forget that they should just raise their hand and just wait for a second. Granted, after several instances of Mr. Shepherd all but shouted in his ear, the poking isn't so bad. After a year or two at Atlantis Academy, these random touches rampage out of control whenever he runs into old inhabitants of Room 12. Suddenly he's swarmed three deep with hugs around the waist, usually the third graders, fourth graders simply giggle and shriek, either gender, or high fives, boys of any age, hanging on his hands, elbows, and waist until he leaves. Part of him feels guilty for causing so much chaos, especially the day he makes the mistake of cutting through the auditorium during the fourth grader's whole grade play practice, his ears still ring, but makes him smile after at that memory of all the laughing faces caught in a transition from the familiar child to the strange adult. He and Rodney are out getting coffee on one Saturday morning, a 5-minute trip that turned into a lengthy wander through the grocery store, where John has to explain 4 times that no, they don't need that. They already have 1, 2, or 3 of this already, and yes, Franklin has plenty of food, toys, treats, and no, just no. So he's a little irritated and cranky, and hungry, but that's what happens when you go to the grocery store after breakfast of only coffee, and contemplating several nasty things he could say to Rodney, who's still standing tensely alone by the entrance when he hears, "Mr. Shepherd!" And his left side is attacked from the chest down by a green winter coat and an orange snow hat. After a moment, John recognizes that it's Heather, now an extremely mature and grown-up fourth grader, with her mother and father and baby brother. She gleefully chatters at him about the fact that they're learning about bugs in Spanish, and Miss Cadman knows all these cool books, just like you do, and they're so funny, and she likes dogs, and we got a dog, a puppy, and is your new class as cool as we were? And her brother's getting new teeth, right in front, and did you know that your tooth will dissolve in soda like it was never there? And grins wider and giggles at the enthusiastically disgusted face John makes for her. Heather is now clutching John's coffee-free hand in her own warm, mittened hand, and is using it to gesture towards her family. John makes some appropriate hi-how-are-you noises to the equally coffee-laden grown-ups and a funny face for the brother still in the stroller. But most of his attention is following Heather's rapid account of the new game that Coach Ronan taught them. "I got a big bruise, but I didn't cry, and then Coach sent Jimmy to the office for throwing the ball at me," and promising that, yes, he still had Tolstoy the turtle, and yes, she could come by and visit him, and the little kid someday. Heather finally winds down, still grinning, and with a gleeful goodbye launches herself down the sidewalk after her family. John turns to see that Rodney hasn't moved and is alone, still all tense shoulders and pinched look to his face as he sips his coffee, staring down at his shoes. The look tightens even more when John gets close enough for Rodney to notice. John feels his hands start to sweat a little bit around the coffee cup and wonders why he'd been so furious at the idea of a block of cheese. "Sorry, I get a little overstimulated in the face of all that food," Rodney bursts out. "We really don't need more cat food, but I know that Franklin gets pissy when he's hungry and it's on sale." The easy thing, John knows, would be to agree by way of apology and go in and let Rodney buy more cat food. The easy thing would be to make fun of Rodney's tendency to think with his stomach. The easiest thing would be to say some of those nasty things he'd been thinking before. Instead, John smiles and reaches out to grab Rodney's free hand, feeling the chilled fingers warm against his palm. Grocery stores make me crazy, too. I recommend home, food, couch. Rodney's hand tightens in John's as his face loosens and he moves closer, letting their shoulders bump. "Home, food, couch, bad movies?" Rodney counters with a quirked eyebrow. John knows that really means kissing in a warm tangle on the couch, trying to mesmerize the touch of Rodney's mouth, the weight of his hip beneath his, their fingers tracing his spine and muscle and skin. "Sounds good to me," he says, and lets the momentum of their joined hands pull him back toward the front door. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback for the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this story's post. Thanks for listening. Overflow, an elementary verse fic by Fly Kate, read by Rhea 314. It's that weird time of year where winter hasn't quite let go of Pennsylvania, but spring's trying like crazy to get in on the fun. So John's ditched the blazer he'd put on that morning and shoved the sleeves of his button down up to the elbows and finds that he's still humming that damn song Room 12 learned that morning in music class. "Tell me, little fishy, how deep is the sea, how deep is the sea?" As he digs his keys out of his pocket to open the door. And part of his brain must still be back in the lesson about Angel Island. "Sorry, Ben, not actual angels. Well, it's sort of a metaphor. Peter, no. Jenna, that won't be on the test. Yes, P-H-O-R. Sometimes P's sound like an F. It's one thing that can stand for something else, Amanda. Anyway." Because they'd already dumped the keys, pile of papers, backpack, and pointless blazer in the hall before he's noticed how warm it is in the apartment. That smell, cloying clean, and oh no, he didn't. But John can hear the sound of Rodney's steps towards the hall, and even though they're still muffled by the kitchen door, and the puddled, noises solidify into Rodney's head peeking around the opening door, embarrassed indignation in every spot of color flushing his face, in the line of drying soap suds along his jaw. "Oh, he did," John thinks with something close to pity. "Washing machine?" John guesses. The tightening of Rodney's shoulders is his answer. Rodney steps through the door towards John, and past him, John can see the damage, a clear half-inch of soapy water spreading through the kitchen and determinedly making an effort to soak into the hallway carpet, ripples from the filled sink still cascading periodically over the edge of the counter and down, down, down to the floor, and everywhere the sharp scent of soap. "It's nice to see that the kitchen and laundry room share the same pipes after all," John says, which might have been innocent enough, but then Rodney is just off and running. "I tried to call your landlord 3 times already, but he must still be on vacation, and seriously, whoever leaves for the weekend and doesn't have a cell phone clearly needs to be reported to the Better Landlords Bureau or something. And then I almost had to call Lorne, for God's sake, because I figured that someone who runs his own construction company would know how to make sense of the rat warren of the piping that you have in this house. And couldn't you have rented someplace that didn't look like it was going to fall over at a moment's notice? But then, I know I never would have had the end of it with every softball beer night he'd bring up. And I swear, who would have thought about one load of laundry would make our entire house explode? This is why I leave the household chores to you. My brain is clearly more suitable to abstract concepts like gravity and acceleration, and did I say I'm sorry, I'm sorry." This ramble lasts long enough for John to pick his way across the kitchen, squish, and to the doorway of the laundry room, squish, squish, to see that, yeah, there's the culprit, a small pile of wet clothes huddled sadly on top of the washing machine. And it's not even Rodney's laundry, it's their laundry. John can see the curl of fabric that must be one of Rodney's t-shirts, and the tangle of what could be one of the horrendous purple socks that Madison had given Uncle John last Christmas. And only the flannel blanket John uses to keep warm while grading papers in the living room is quite that color plaid. Something about mostly the hilarity that's ready to burst out of his mouth in big braids of laughter grabs John by the throat,
and he has to swallow hard. He knows that Rodney would probably be amused about forgetting that the sink had backed up the night before, and that John had promised to call a plumber before him school, and somewhere in Rodney's email box there was definitely one that said, R, plumber at 4, Chinese for dinner, don't work too hard, J. But the other part of him knows to simply walk squish-squish over to Rodney, smooth a hand across his shoulders, feeling them drop a little lower in response, and say, I'll get towels from upstairs. Franklin's hiding under the bed, Rodney says, as some kind of response, which makes John grin as he heads upstairs, when Rodney says, with all the pauses that his rant had been missing, I just wanted to do something nice for you. You always... Here he flaps a hand wordlessly, and John feels something else clench in his throat, not laughter but joy, a wave of happiness and amazement, and an undercurrent of, how do I have this? How am I so lucky to get this? You do, John ducks his head, feeling shy and scared and a little bit vulnerable. For me, I mean, you do nice things for me, a lot. Rodney's smile is equally shy, but then John can't take it any longer and blurts out, you have something on your chin. And then Rodney throws the wet dish towel he's holding, and John has to run for the stairs pretending not to hear the dire threats of further catastrophe as he buries his laughter in piles of bath towels, in the clean soap scent of home. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback for the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this story's post. Thanks for listening.
Lips and Hearts, an elementary verse fic by Flyacate, read by Rhea 3-4. It's the few weeks before that bring it up again, make it immediate. John walks around all day with an ache behind his eyes and a tightness in his chest. Both finally make sense only after he's picked up and put away the 10th and 11th lovingly scribbled art projects that say, in pink, pen, blue glitter, purple pencil, dabs of drying paint, I love you, Mom. Mother's Day soon, he tells Rodney that night, after the easy shift for position of arms and legs and pillows. Rodney always tugs half the covers back, sneaky bastard. Yeah? Rodney says with a tilt of surprise in his voice that says he hasn't been thinking about it either. Then, yeah, a warm hand curling around John's, a short rub of thumb against the back of it. It's enough for John's shoulders to relax, the ache to ease, so he can sleep. Halfway through quiet reading a week later, when most of John's attention is on the Red Group, helping their quiet struggle with A Day at the Beach, several kids still at their desks decide this is the perfect time to talk about what their fathers are getting for their mothers for Mother's Day. Dad's hopeless, whispers Jordan, at volume that is twice as loud as he thinks it is. He had to take my sisters with him to the jewelry store, and they texted Mom 3 times. My dad always forgets until Sunday morning, says Amanda with something like glee, so my mom gets a lot of gift certificates. This dissolves into a debate about which presents are the most romantic, because second graders are such great judges of romance. And John is about to get up and shut down the talking. He's been hoping it would quiet down on its own. Hey, it happens. When another overly loud voice breaks through. What about you, Kara? Kara's pretty quiet as a rule, always follows directions, funny as hell, and when she smiles, John can tell she's going to break hearts in high school, though he's biased that way about most of his kids. So quiet he almost misses it. The look on her face, the way it pales and tightens, and oh, he remembers that look, can feel the ghost of it on his own face. Before he can say anything, she's up and out of her chair, barely glancing in John's direction. You're supposed to ask to leave the room, and it's May, so they all know, before she's gone. God, Jordan, get a clue, hisses Amanda. Don't you remember that Kara's mom died last year? Whatever Jordan says, John can't hear, or hears but can't quite understand because his heart is beating too loud in his ears. And did the AC just cut out because it's hot? And how can the kids not be staring at him? Amanda is, but only because she saw Kara leave. Escape, part of John's brain offers. And after a blink of troubled eyes, she turns her head back to her workbook. Somehow John makes it through the Red Group and A Day at the Beach, the Blues and Pete's school project, which is Kara's group, but he doesn't say anything when she's not there, still not back yet, and for once the rest of the students don't seem to notice, don't helpfully remind him about it, which is only another kind of tattling, really. And it's halfway through brave Balto's journey with the Green Group when the lunch bell rings. Push in your chairs. He tries to pitch his voice above the glaring chaos of boys and girls who have just remembered that they are starving and need to eat 5 seconds ago. We'll read the rest of the chapter when we get back from lunch, he tells the small group squirming to be released from the table, biting back a smile at the sour look Joey is throwing him. "But what about math, Mr. Shepherd?" asks Ben, and if John hadn't been doing this for a while, he'd almost be taken in by the fake concern loading the words. "I think we'll fit it in somewhere," John assures him, trying to slide some humor into it, even as his palms still feel itchy and he can't really think or breathe. Room 12 is mostly quiet and in a mostly straight line to the classroom door, so John does an absent-minded sweep of the room with his eyes, doesn't see any glaring mess on the desk or floor. Although, if he's really honest with himself at this point, Tolstoy could have escaped from his cage and started doing the Macarena in the middle of the room, and he would have missed it. And walks the kids to the lunchroom, though as usual the line disintegrates after about 5 feet. Except for Amanda and Jenna, but John's not pretty sure that's only because they're deep in some important conversation involving sleepovers and cookie dough, not that he's eavesdropping or anything, and a gaggle of boys who always seem to compete to see who can walk the absolute slowest. Eventually he's herded them all to tables in the cafeteria line. Pizza today, which John stopped finding exciting after his first or second year at Atlantis. Turns out when you're not 7 and eating everything in sight, pizza gives you a stomachache. Now to find Kara, not that she could go anywhere. It's an enclosed building with enough locked doors that, for once, John is glad instead of mildly creeped out. "Mr. Shepherd." Amanda still standing at the door to the cafeteria. "Yes, Amanda?" Normally he'd manage a smile, but it's beyond him at the moment. "When you see Kara, can you tell her that me and Jenna and Susie are saving her a seat at lunch?" Sometimes kids are too much, John thinks, and feels something tighten his throat for a minute, something proud and sad all at once. And whoever said kids are stupid has never met one, John thinks. "Sure, Amanda. I'll tell her. Now go on," John says, and Amanda grins brightly and the door closes. The student restrooms are on the way back to the classroom, so John ducks his head into the fourth grade, where, like he thought, Laura Cadman is still scribbling herself notes about the next lesson. Either that or making a dinner date with Carson, but now isn't the time to tease. "Got a minute?" John asks, and the change in Laura's expression says that he hasn't been hiding as much of what he'd been thinking about as he thought. "Sure, what's up?" "Well," John says, and he feels himself shift his weight, tells himself to get a grip. "One of my kids made a break for it in the middle of class and hasn't come back yet. Now that the coast is clear, I'm sure she's trying to sneak into lunch and hope I'll forget the whole thing. But on the off chance that she'd hold up in a bathroom..." Laura laughs a bit. "Oh, I see, you have need for my singular talents," she grins and follows him. But after she ducks into the girls' room for a moment, she's back, shaking her head. "Damn. I try your room again, or maybe the nurse's office? Who was it?" "Kara Wells." "Oh." And now Laura's smile is a touch sadder. "Was it something about her mother? I had her brother Nick last year, poor guy. It's tough, especially this time of year." "Yeah," John says, and God, he hopes to keep the wobble out of his voice. When they reach room 12, John can hear a muted squeak and shuffle that means someone's inside, a thump and a soft zip that must be Kara getting her lunchbox out of her backpack. "Want me to talk to her?" Laura says, something enough like understanding in her voice that John almost gives in, but feels enough of the tension in his slowly clenching fist that he shakes his head. "No, thanks. Besides," and here he can grin, "you have to get back to drawing hearts around Carson's name or something." He leans away from Laura's swat, barely, and lets her get farther away before opening the door to the classroom. Sure enough, at the noise of the door opening, Kara's head pokes around the cupboard where the kids all hang or madly pile their backpacks. For one long second she doesn't move, but finally she emerges with the lunchbox clenched so tightly it probably hurts. "Hey, Kara," John says, wishing this could be easier. "Why don't you come and sit for a second?" "'Kay," she answers, after a minute, and she slowly shuffles into a chair at the reading table. "I was worried when you left the room without asking," John begins, and a slow flush starts on Kara's face. Barely, and only because he was expecting it, he can hear a noise of apology, though Kara's chin is now tucked to her chest, her hair falling forward. "Are you okay?" John knows what a stupid question this is, and the sarcastic voice he always thinks of as Rodney answers back, "Gee, John, what do you think? Were you then? Are you now?" Kara shrugs with half a head nod, which is more than John was expecting. "I'm not mad at you, Kara. I figure that you've left without asking. It was for an important reason." Firmer nod this time. Like if you were feeling bad, I know that when I feel bad, or if I'm sad or angry, I need to be by myself to feel a bit better. Which isn't particularly true, but Kara is actually looking at him now, and the look in her eyes just about breaks John's heart. I know when Jordan asked about your mom that it made you upset, and I know because... John swallows, throat raw. When I was your age, people would ask me questions like that after my mom was gone, and I'd be upset too. Your mom's gone too? Kara's voice wobbles, and John can't swallow, only nod, and see her face both brighten and twist, a shiver as tears begin to slip down her face. I really miss her, she whispers, and John leans over, slides an arm over her shoulders. I know you do, honey, is all he says, and Kara cries. It's not long. John's pretty sure she's been crying in the bathroom while she was gone, and eventually Kara's down to sniffles and staring at the table again. John sits for a minute, breathes slowly, trying to work past the memory of the teacher who hadn't known, had told John off for not drawing his mom in a family portrait for art. He'd cried in the bathroom, torn up the paper before his dad could even see it, and crams a smile back in his voice. It's okay to be sad, John says quietly, because every kid has a right to be sad, not to suck it up and be a grown-up, not yet, not ever, about this. And if you're ever sad and need to talk to someone, just let me know, okay? Kara nods, head pillowed on John's shoulders. Now why don't you get a drink of water and a tissue, and then if we hurry, you can still make it for the rest of lunch and recess. John lowers his voice conspiratorially. I heard that Amanda, Jenna, and Susie are even saving you a seat. Kay, Kara says, like before. But her voice is louder, calmer. She takes the tissue John finds for her, blows her nose twice, and gives John a closer approximation of a normal smile. There's a knock on the door, and then Laura Cadman pokes her head in. I'm on my way to the teacher's lounge, Mr. Shepherd, she says with a seemingly ignorant smile. Need anything? No, I'm good, John says, though the idea of food doesn't sound as impossible as it had before. Though actually talking to someone, the kid sitting next to him at lunch always got a note from his mom saying she loved him. John used to pick them out of the garbage and read them, wishing they were his. Sounds tiring. Hey, Kara, do you want to walk with Miss Cadman? Just so she doesn't get lost? He whispers, and Kara smiles a little wider and heads to the door. After she's turned, John mouths thank you to Laura, who widens her eyes in a who me sort of way. The door clicks closed. John leans back, feels the itch of his palms slowly slip away, the ache in his throat become manageable. He stands and goes to dig his lunch out of the class fridge. Hell, maybe Tolstoy wants the lettuce in his sandwich. While John hates acronyms, right now he's highly willing to thank God, or really anyone else, that it's Friday. Friday means the hour earlier dismissal, means that after he picks up the kids from lunch, it's a quick math lesson involving a slightly more educational version of blackjack, then a double period of P.E. with Ronan that burns off the edge of restless energy that's been hanging around room 12, because they can tell something's up with John, too. John decides to sit in, and so is witness to the hilarity that his 22nd graders playing kickball, and then a laughter-filled game of tag, where they have to move in blobs of two or three kids holding hands. He sees Kara stuck in the middle of a crowd of girls, all gleefully it, and he feels his throat tighten again. If Ronan is surprised to see him hang around, he doesn't say anything. It's not too long after that, especially because Atlantis is still in a lull before report cards, so John can get the hell out of there. That John is opening the front door, dumping his keys and mail on the table, and his bag on the floor, and then he allows inertia to set in just enough so that he stands there. You just have to hear what the freshman said in class today. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to applaud his highly articulate stupidity or send a letter to the high school that let him pass any science class ever. Hey. Suddenly there was Rodney's hand on his shoulder to go with the voice, Rodney's thumb worrying at the collar of John's shirt. John allows himself to lean into it a little and says softly, A girl. In my class. In the bathroom for most of reading because some kid asked her about Mother's Day and her mom died last year. And... John feels his throat start to close a bit, works his jaw even as he feels Rodney step closer, hand cupping his neck, close enough that he can finish it. I talked to her about it. About my mom, and that it was okay to be sad. Rodney's near enough that John can step into him, tuck his chin over Rodney's shoulder, feel his breathing. I'm glad. And Rodney's hand is on his back, barely moving an emotion that John still finds calming. I'm glad she had someone to talk to. Yeah? Jean wishes he didn't sound so young and hopeful. Yeah. And now Rodney's pressing a kiss to John's temple, still holding him close. You should have. John feels his jaw tighten, his eyes start to sting. Rodney. Rodney pulls away enough that John can see his face, and wow, he is furious. No, John, I get to be mad about this. I get to be absolutely, completely incensed that your asshole of a father never helped you talk about your mother and, instead of letting you and your brother grieve, he shut you down and closed you off and eventually sent you to boarding school. It was tradition, Rodney, not some kind of punishment. Instead of just loving you, that's what he was supposed to do. Rodney's down to a whisper now, right in John's ear. His voice sounds as wrecked as John feels inside. Just love you. Let you know that it's okay to miss her and okay to feel sad. John swallows, feels a shudder work its way up his back as his hands fist in Rodney's shirt. I really miss her. He manages, with barely the time to process being embarrassed about it, bursts into tears. Rodney's hand doesn't stop moving up and down John's back, but he doesn't murmur anything ridiculous and false in his ears about it being all right, or hum some other romantic movie crap. An ex-girlfriend had once gotten John to talk, and yeah, cry about his mom, but the whole thing had felt so damn fake and manipulative that John had ended up feeling sadder as well as irritated by the whole thing. But just lets John stand there in the front hall and cry. John feels the tears slow enough that he is actually noticing each hesitant slip of wetness down his face. Now he has a hitch in his throat every third breath, that Rodney has somehow maneuvered them down the hall and into the bedroom, onto sheets that smell faintly of detergent and stronger of them and rest and peace. Sorry, John says, scrubbing a hand across his face, and then shaking his head a little when he realizes he isn't being clear. I'm sorry that I don't talk about her much. You know you can, though, Rodney says, and there's enough of a question to that that John kisses him an answer, in a soft brush of lips and air. John falls back against the sheets, part of him reveling in the sheer pleasure of lying on a bed on a Friday afternoon, the stretch of a lazy weekend before them, twisting sideways so that their feet tangle as they kiss. Yeah, John says, because it's important to say it, to let Rodney hear it out loud. It makes it real. Hell, it makes it true. Tell me something about her, Rodney says, and some of the ache that's still in John's heart, I love you, Mom, eases at the gentleness of the request. John thinks. She hated green beans. Her favorite color, she'd said, was the grayish-blue bruise of a rain cloud in a thunderstorm. She had taught John to dance one afternoon, laughing. She had a great laugh. She would have liked you, John answers. And it's not going to be fixed, this, not really. He can still feel the rawness of it, scraped thin, and an answering shudder of Rodney's breathing feels like the tears clinging salt to his face. But it's better, truer, and Rodney leans in with a kiss full of rest and peace and home. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback for the author. You can do that at a link in the text through this story's post. Thanks for listening. Shutterbug, an elementary verse fic, by Flya Kate, read by Rethru and Four. June, after his first year at Atlanta's Academy, having survived second graders and recess duties, field trips, and a never-ending epidemic of the flu, Taylor, who had been his mentor, thank Elizabeth Weir, had given John a present, a heavy leather photo album, already a third full with pictures from the school play, based on some folktale John remembered from grad school, which involved all the second graders dressing up in blues and purples, the hilarious costume he was forced to wear in the Halloween parade, a flurry of moments and laughter captured on film that John had almost forgotten, the record of Room 12's shift from just another classroom into his. I always think it's good to remember what it was like at the beginning, Taylor had said when he thanked her. Then she'd grinned. For when it gets worse. John had taken pictures of his own over the year, a habit left over from his credentialing portfolio to prove masterful teaching, or to prove that John wasn't just tying kids up instead of talking about multiplication. So he adds to the blanks, spending an amused summer afternoon tucking in a picture of Harry Parker showing Natalie how to play chess, a blurry shot of a small brown blob that John has thoughtfully labeled Tolstoy the Turtle, just in case he ever forgets, and even a photo secretly taken of the faculty at the Christmas party, where Ronan, Laura, Aiden, and Elizabeth had gotten absolutely smashed and decided to dance the Macarena. The next year starts with its usual chaos, but John still finds time to take, and more importantly, store new pictures. Where Kelly gleefully smiles over her completed model of the water cycle, never mind that it had soaked the whole carpet in blue food coloring a minute later. Or even Lorne and the rest of the softball team sitting around a bar table, mouths open in some shout that John can still almost hear. He always tries to get his shots of the classroom, especially when the kids are actually following directions, as opposed to killing each other, though there is a memorable picture of Rob and Greg grinning at the camera with an immense Tinker Toy weaponry clutched in their hands. But try is extra hard on field trips, and it's funny how the simplest pictures... One's a half-bird slice of kid's elbow, probably Paul trying to chuck a sandwich. Remind him the look when room 12 first touches a dolphin after an endless bus ride of white-knuckled screaming fits. However, there aren't any pictures for everything, so he's just stuck plain remembering how Laura first smiled shyly when sitting next to Carson at a faculty meeting, or the look of proud awe on some kids of the kids' faces after the round of applause at the talent show. A parody of John and his love of Johnny Cash that which had made Ronan laugh so hard he almost cried. John sticks Christmas cards in the album, too, and a copy of the graduation program when his second graders graduated to middle school, junior high, leaving the Atlantis for good. It's halfway through September, several years later, when John comes back from the bathroom at the Franklin Institute to find Peter Adams enthusiastically arguing the pros and cons of Bones, with a middle-aged man whose irritation explodes in twists of anxious finger waves, and the slightly raised tufts of his thinning hair. And, man, how he wishes he had a picture for that. Not that he thinks he'll ever forget, of course. John finds room in the album for a picture of Franklin, gamely holding his own against Tolstoy, at home for winter vacation, and even manages to get one of him and Rodney when they spend a couple of weeks in Florida, a joint blackmailing by both John and Jeannie to get the whole family to Walt Disney World. Though Rodney had drawn the line at wearing the Mickey ears, till Madison pouted, and Rodney had forced a pair on John when he couldn't stop laughing. Still, it had been worth it to see the look on Rodney's face when Madison wanted to pinky swear that she could come visit the big school where Uncle Rodney teaches. Oh yeah, and Uncle John's turtle, too. John is still proud of the shot he got of Rodney and his sister just before leaving, the way Rodney's face looked before they hugged. A smile that spoke of calm and belonging and family that he'd forgotten he had. John's lying flat on the bed, paging through the album, thumb warring at the bottom edge of the cover, where the leather is starting to peel back. "What are you up to?" Rodney asks, his voice muffled by the towel as he dried his hair. "Marveling at just how much you look like Mickey Mouse," John mutters, grinning a bit at the indignant squawk that issues from the towel. "Just remembering." He flips another page, time slipping in reverse, until it was a picture during new student orientation. John and Taylor, grins a little frantic or serene, depending, and John can feel without looking that Rodney has walked over, is leaning and looking down at the picture, too. "Hey," Rodney says, like he's caught hold of some of the seriousness in John's voice. A hand reaches out, brushes John's shoulder, and there's an ease of the mattress as Rodney sits down. "You look nervous in this." John grins. "Terrified that the kids would hate me, I think. That I would suck as a teacher. You know, the usual." John shrugs. God, he'd look so young then. Rodney leans flat so that he's lined up against John's side, tugs his chin against John's shoulder. "You are always an idiot," he offers, warm voice against John's chin. "And it's nice to know that your hair defied gravity even then." "And, you know, I was pretty hot then, too," John offers, and feels more than he hears Rodney's laugh. A shaking amusement as he lets go of the album with one hand and slides fingers around Rodney's wrist with the other. "You were," Rodney says, and John knows that he's grinning, can feel it even before he tilts his head and fits himself against it. "But then you're pretty hot now, too." "Oh yeah?" John tries to raise an eyebrow after kissing Rodney, but his attention's not really in it. "Only pretty hot?" But Rodney knows him. There's pictures to prove it. And only lets his palm curve behind John's neck, the other smoothing the skin under the hem of his t-shirt. "Yes, yes, you were and are the epitome of all hot things. Now do you want the rest of your birthday present, or not?" And John laughs, lets Rodney kiss him silent, and allows the photo album to slowly slide to the floor. The end. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback for the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this story's post. Thanks for listening.